the most drastic thing that you can do to create this event. that's one of them. Keep in mind, ferroresonance is basically it's a very loosely used term. The other thing that can happen too is that if you get a voltage surge or a voltage spike, that basically takes place and it basically drives the transformer into saturation, and that's what happens. And then you start square topping either the current or the voltage. In this particular case, where you're getting the overvoltages, you're getting very, very high spiked currents with the primary voltage, and then it basically causes the transformer to saturate and peak, you know, basically peak saturate, and then the next thing you know, after that, it folds up into this kind of like, because it's drawing a very high current out of the generator almost goes into a quasi-current limiting that it goes into, and then basically it recovers and happens again and recovers. So it's kind of like forcing the transformer in and out of saturation as the, you know, and it usually happens on one phase. So basically one phase starts going in and out of saturation, basically in a kind of like a handshaking oscillation mode between the transformer and the generator. The best way to resolve that is you need a transformer that's heavier duty with a higher saturation point. But unfortunately, it sounds like you were in an aircraft environment and you were shooting for lower weight, and the idea of putting in larger cross-sectional area transformers may not have been the solution, where there again, it sounds like maybe current sensing and some kind of circuit breaker might have been the solution there. But typically, to prevent it from happening, a much larger transformer is the way around it, Dick, just to prevent it from saturating under all costs. Back to you, and then I'll go further.
Yeah, I'm fairly sure that what the designers have done with the request for a quote or request for a bid on this particular power supply, because it went into a box that was already a two-man lift. The box, the line replaceable unit, as I remember, was something like 120 pounds. We're never supposed to exceed something like 60 or 70 pounds and so on. So there was a limited weight requirement, a limited volume requirement. The right solution would have been more iron in the transformer, or iron in the transformer that's probably more expensive, that saturates at a higher BH curve, if you know what I mean. And I think because of the overall constraint to this particular problem, we didn't have that luxury. There was a circuit breaker that would independently sense the circuit on each of the three phases, and if any one of the three phases exceeded the right amount of current, then the whole circuit breaker, all three phases, was opened. So yes, we would reset the whole thing and start all over again. But this scary event, as I said, occurred to us once or twice per month. Another aggravating factor, let me drop this, was the fact that the motor generator set that was on campus was probably also a little bit undersized. I think when it was feeding everything, I'm remembering that motor generator was something about 3 or 4 feet in diameter and maybe about 4 feet long. I'm going to make a guess it was good for 50 kilowatts or something like that. And we probably were drawing total current output, total power output was approaching those numbers when all three simultaneous laboratories running side by side are running off the same motor generator set. And there was some kind of a built-in magnetic regulator in that motor generator set that I'll bet you that regulator went a little bit crazy when it saw these extremely high currents on one phase at a time because of a saturating transformer. So we had a kind of a chaotic behavior network there that occasionally gave us this grief. So I think you got the right solution, a bigger transformer, and I think because of our size and weight restrictions, we probably didn't have the ability to do that. If you were the designer of that transformer at the transformer factory, without increasing the weight, without increasing the size, is there the possibility you could have paid more dollars for the iron, so to speak, and give us a partial solution within those constraints? What do you think, Glenn? KC2QIQ, wait a few extra seconds. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Grounding. Glenn, if you can say something about it.
Okay, Wesley, I'll put that one on the list. Okay, generally what you can do, here's another trick. Voltage saturation in a transformer can typically either be, in other words, you can increase the peak plus in a transformer, let's say by voltage range, by adding more turns to the transformer, which means that if the transformer can't grow, that means the wire gauge is going to be a little little bit more lossy and going to have more heat. But here again, if you have a box and you can heat sink it or put materials inside it to draw the heat off the transformer, the best thing to do would be to keep the turns ratio the same, but increase the total number of primary and secondary turns. And this way the voltage point of saturation is higher. Now, will that transformer run hotter? Yes. But now you heat sink the box and fill it with some kind of a material that will allow the heat to draw into the box and then heat sink the box and the transformer. That would be the other alternate solution, Vic, on that one.
Yeah, this whole line replaceable unit had a so-called chill plate down the center with coolant oil continuously flowing through it. So an oil cooling fuel, oil cooling, here we go, a heat cooling oil was continuously flowing through the box. And so with a slight minor modification, that power transformer could have been more heat sunk to that chill plate and or maybe some of the oil flow be put through channels of the iron itself. So I see your approach. By increasing the number of turns on the primary and the number of turns on the secondary, the same amount of voltage on primary and secondary is now creating a smaller amount of saturation, a smaller amount of ampere turns on the primary, smaller amount of magnetic field, and therefore less of the saturation as you move further and further away from the saturation threshold for the magnetics. You have a lower and lower probability of running into this fault condition. And so that's a beautiful solution. I never heard any of the power supply mavens that were on campus at that time use those words, Glenn. I know that we were leaning on the power supply transformer manufacturer trying to get a solution, and I think he told us that his hands were tied. Okay, if you can say anything on the subject of grounding, which when it comes to magnetic field, let me drop. When it comes to shielding 60-cycle magnetic field and even 400-cycle magnetic field, a transformer that is capable of producing very strong magnetic fields, to locally shield circuits away from that is very difficult. The depth of penetration you get in magnetic circuits, I mean, just encasing the transformer with a completely closed six-sided copper box, building a screen room around the transformer, so to speak, to an RF person sounds like a solution. You talk to a magnetic person, you say, that's not a solution. Putting so-called mu metal, this is a kind of metal with extremely high permeability around it, gives you a partial solution. But grounding and magnetic shielding, that in itself is an art and a science, isn't it, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it is, Dick. And the key there is steel. If you really want to block a magnetic field, you use steel. You need to block more of it, you use thicker steel. And that's really the main solution to it. New metals and other things like that, the amount of heat and other things that derive from it, there's no free lunch. But typically the best material that I know of, in other words, if you want to take a transformer and prevent it from disturbing a digital circuit, or some kind of, especially hard drives. Hard drives are really not happy with strong magnetic fields. So a steel enclosure, sometimes a thin one will do it. If the field is really strong, the only thing you can do is increase the density or the thickness of the steel around the transformer. In the earlier equipment, if you remember equipment going back to the 40s through the 60s, when people started realizing this could be a problem even with tube circuits, what they would do is they literally took metal cans and made little covers for the transformers, and they used them as a thin steel. And those plates, you took those plates off, you had all kinds of problems. Put those little plates back on, you had a much better audio amplifier. You got less hum, much easier to neutralize. So, yes, using steel is one of the best ways to contain strong magnetic fields in grounding. I'm not sure if that answers Wesley's question, but I'll throw it back to you first, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
So putting enough steel and making the steel thick enough does it, and my guess is that's got to be magnetic steel, so-called 18-8 stainless steel, might not do it. Am I correct on that one, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, let's put it this way. It may do it, it may not. Stainless steel is always great because of the ability not to tarnish. So there again, a good painting around the outside might be necessary. But then again, that's not to say that stainless steel. Stainless steel is going to be a lot better than other materials, but certainly just a good, you know, high-grade steel, and wrapping a transformer around it is some of the best protection you can get.
But now, approaching what Wesley is asking, is there any kind of fancy grounding technique, shields and grounding within the transformer, grounding on particular windings, grounding on the circuitry around it? Can the word grounding help in these networks at all, to your knowledge, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, one of the advantages to a transformer or transformer-related circuits is the ability for isolation, total galvanic isolation, primary to secondary. In other words, you can hide primary to secondary. You get very, very high insulation properties between primary and secondary. So typically, grounding should not be an issue. I mean, granted, there's coupling effects between windings and things like that, but typically the idea behind using a transformer is to isolate ground. So maybe Wesley can give us a couple more words of what he really would like to do with grounding and what effect he's thinking is having on his circuit, because, I mean, certainly grounding is a very important part in almost all electrical circuits, especially the higher you go in frequency. Grounding can be really important, and even in DC circuits, because if you have voltage drops across your ground, that can also be a problem. So maybe I should shoot this back to Wesley and find out more what he'd like to know about grounding, because I'm not sure what the question really is.
The certain power systems configuration will increase the network susceptibility to ferroresonance. So, let's see, protection switching equipment operates on single phases and leaf sections of the network open. And they, of course, effectively creating a series of LC circuits that is excited by these remaining phases. And equipment grounding, it is also of concern. And, for example, ungrounded Y-connected transformer may exceed the open circuit phases, whereas the Y-connected transformer disallow it. They have effect on the ferroresonance susceptibility, if I pronounce it properly. What I'm trying to say is, find out is that limit to the damage of distribution system that is sustaining over voltages should be then differs somehow when there is a good grounding and good shielding comparable versus to the one that is not shield effective.
Glenn, I'm going to guess that if the sensing circuitry in the protection network for your particular installation can sense the fact that an unusual current on any one winding or an unusual voltage on any one winding takes place and then trips a circuit breaker for all three phases and then starts the process all over again, I'm getting the impression that that's one of the better kinds of protection once you get into one of these undesired federal resonance conditions of three-phase power. Some of the machinery that John and Wesley are buying are motors that need to run on three-phase power. So ultimately, these guys are going to be getting into three-phase power and three-phase power transformers and three-phase motors. Therefore, I think they're vulnerable to these conditions. And so, do you know of a better protection other than a three-phase current sense, three-phase voltage sense, and proper threshold sensing on a common circuit breaker? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
You said a mouthful there, Dick. I mean, realistically, whenever you're dealing with three-phase circuits, always having ganged circuit breakers. And if anything, try to use circuit breakers that are below the peak limit. So in other words, when you're doing your initial testing and you're bringing something up, try not to oversize your circuit breakers. If anything, try to undersize them a little bit. If you're expecting to run at eventually up to 500 watts, try maybe 100 watts worth of circuit breaker in the beginning until you get things running and seeing how it properly behaves. Make sure you got cutoffs, things that, so if one phase goes dead on you in south and starts drawing a lot of current, it knocks off all three. You know, would you really want to have that kind of cutoff? Any kind of current sensing, whether it be a circuit breaker or more sophisticated circuits that are actually measuring the current in each leg, and then if something happens, you cut off all three. That's also a very good thing. Wesley, I understand what you were saying also about your grounding and about shielding. Yes, they're all important. Keep in mind, I'm not sure I really heard a question there more than a statement from you, but I would have to agree with you in that, yes, you need shielding and good grounding on these circuits, because when you have high voltage transformers that are basically going in and out of saturation, you're going to get large fields, and those fields can spray all over everything. They'll get into other equipment, into your other nearby circuits, and give you all kinds of erroneous effects, give your test equipment all kinds of havoc. Let me let it drop for a second. So if you can allow, in other words, if you build your circuits in stages, and there are multiple stages, if you can treat each stage as something separate and build it with, you know, with your transformer couplings, your inductors, and put them into like little boxes, if you can, at all possible, and have, you know, shielded input and output cables, it's good for two reasons. One is that it keeps all that electromagnetic noise way low, and it also protects you as the individual from working with higher voltages. In other words, keeping things shielded and grounded, and just very good things all the way around. Let me pass it back to Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I have one more thing to add before we end this subject.
Very fine, Wesley. When it comes to properly sizing a circuit breaker, my goodness, did you say a mouthful on that one, Glenn? The best example I know of, again on the B-1 Bomber program, Airborne Instruments Laboratory, Deer Park, New York, 1986, a technician was working on a power supply on a bench. The power supply was being fed 400 cycle, three-phase power. The local circuit breaker, I think, was rated for 35 amperes. He was told the power was turned off, and he was about to be doing some rewiring of the primary circuit. He didn't know the power was still on. A little bit foolish on his part to know that, to take his digital voltmeter and remeasure to be sure the power was off. So he thought the power was off. It wasn't. And as he starts climbing into the circuitry, his screwdriver fell from phase A to phase B of a 240-volt three-phase circuit, which is supposedly rated for 35 amperes. The screwdriver drew enough current that it took a chunk out of the screwdriver, sprayed hot steel all over the place, singed the daylights out of the eyebrows and the front of his hair on the front of his head, sunburned his face, didn't damage his eyes, but his face ended up sunburned, his eyebrows ended up scorched, and the front of his hair on his head ended up scorched just from a momentary touch of a screwdriver across two of the phases. The circuit breaker, rated for 35 amperes, did not trip. The actual event of the screwdriver there, burning off the tip of the screwdriver, probably only occurred for milliseconds. The current that flowed during those milliseconds, I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find it was 5,000 amperes, but it was such an abrupt event that the time delay and mechanical delay, the mass of the circuit breaker did not get a
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Did not get a chance to sense the event and therefore trip. Was there a fault in that circuit breaker? They went back and tested it, slowly raised the current to 35 amperes, and it did trip. So why it didn't trip in this event, there's a whole lot of questions on that one. Thank goodness the man's hands did not appear across the 240 volts. Otherwise, there's a high probability he could have been electrocuted. His only real damage was all of the heat and smoke and flame, so to speak, that came out of this circuit breaker, this screwdriver shorting event. I wonder if you've ever heard anything like that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I think, you know, this kind of situation is not an unusual one. It's not, you know, it's not out of the ordinary. When you have very, very high voltage circuits in three phase, you know, even just a 208, three-phase line, 115, line to neutral, and you've got 35 amperes of capability, that power that's available there is tremendous. So it's more than just voltage or current. You know, you think of the 35 volts on a 12-volt power supply and 35 volts at, let's say, on a 208 three-phase line. The 308 line, you've got to be a lot more careful because think of it like on a relay contact. When a relay contactor has to close, look at the size and the rating of that contact when it makes a solid, tight closure without arcing. I mean, you're talking about one hefty relay. Now, if you're talking about, you know, a 208 three-phase line and you drop a screwdriver across it, the screwdriver isn't a perfect contact. It's just a little piece of it is really just going to catch the contact. And when it first hits, that little piece is going to draw a tremendous amount of power and a very, very small part of that screwdriver, and that thing's going to turn black, and you'll see fire, and like you said, the end of it will look like it melted. And it'll be a one heck of a bang. So, you know, you have to be very, very careful with situations like that. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
Commenting.
Okay, we're going to turn it over to Wesley for a quick comment. We're going to temporarily leave the subject and go over to Mel, his mailbag, because we're getting a little bit late, and then we're going to go to Alan in that order. Go ahead and make your last comment before we go over to the mailbag, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RAW and TechNet. And for those on frequency on this particular subject, fear not, we're going to come back to it in about 45 minutes. N2XJN, go right ahead, Wesley.
Yes, N2XJN. Well, when you come back to the subject, John has a very interesting device. Originally, I bought it as a piece of American history. When you were talking about the deep meters employment in this area, he has something better. And he's probably able to add something, and I would like to Glenn to take a stand in that question. How to apply that instrument of John to this particular area. Thank you very much for now, and thank you, all of you, for participating in this subject. And that was it.
Yeah, I know that you own a fancy inductance, capacitance, meter.
Wayne Care Precision Magnetic Analysis. I found the price. The original price was $75,000. The price for used one is $10,000. I bought it for $600.
Sounds to me like you got quite a bargain. And a fancy instrument in its day. And it's very unpopular today. And those are the kind of instruments, and the time domain reflectometer is another instrument, where modern day students in electrical engineering schools are almost not taught about them. The word time domain reflectometry is sometimes mentioned. Grid dip oscillator is never mentioned, in my opinion, in modern day schools. Mel, what's the burning subject that you've been hearing from your mailbag this week? K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Let me let it drop and see if we have anybody else. I'll just give it a good long pause. All right. Well, let's see. Let me see if it's something that is common with younger people. That's what I usually do. Like I say, I have to reject a lot of this that is purely a lot of very deep engineering problems that people are having, and I'm afraid that, again, I have to say this every so often, as Vic will say, if we cannot give a free consulting with things that are a little bit out of the realm of amateur radio that normally we would run into, except here and maybe once in a while on the TechNet, that we do discuss subjects a little off center from amateur radio. Let me let it drop and I'll read one of them here. This one's a good one for you, in fact, the colon one. Okay, here's one. I'm a fairly new ham, and I've gotten myself a nice handy talkie. However, I've gotten some interest in the HF portion of the amateur radio band, and somebody was kind enough to give me a shortwave receiver, the Helicrafters, and I noticed it's got two dials on the front. And one is frequency, the other one's band. The frequency one that seems to work well. The other one, the band spread, when I turn it, nothing really happens. I looked inside and I see there's like a string hanging loose. Can you tell me, is this a repairable situation? Well, I'm sure Dick is an expert when it comes to file cords. Dick, do you want to say a few words to a young person about restringing dial cords? I'm sure you know the tricks of the trade, over.
And so do you, Mel. Unfortunately, an awful lot of the modern people listening to us are not going to know what we're talking about. This is something from the Dark Ages. In the case of radio receivers that were made from the turn of the century all the way up to, I'm going to pick a number, 1980 or so, a high percentage of those radio receivers, in order to have a frequency tuning dial on the front panel, a knob, to have real resolution, you had a shaft that was an eighth of an inch or a quarter of an inch in diameter, and you had a great big wheel that was maybe about 3 inches in diameter connected to the main variable capacitor, the ganged variable capacitor that tuned the RF and local oscillator stages of that superheterodyne radio. And between that shaft, which is about an eighth to a quarter inch diameter, and the 3 inch diameter wheel connected to the ganged capacitor, was dial cord. And it's like a small diameter lacing cord, if you know what I mean. It was made out of some kind of a pretty stoochy cotton with some kind of a waxing on it, and used to be able to buy dial cord a mile at a time. We made jokes about that. Let me drop. And so picture a piece of string that's very heavy thread, so to speak. In other words, sailmaker's thread wrapped around the shaft that goes to the knob to the front panel, and is wrapped around that shaft about 3 times. And it's wrapped around the 3-inch diameter wheel approximately once. But the center of the 3-inch diameter wheel was spring-loaded. So you had the end of the string, after it made a wrap on the 3-inch diameter wheel, went through a notch in that wheel, connected to a spring that went to the center of the shaft of the capacitor, the great big capacitor. So it was an automatic tensioning device on this dial cord. And it was a beautiful vernier technique. It was the poor man's equivalent of a planetary gear system. It was a hell of a lot cheaper to run dial cords instead of planetary gears. That's the good news. The bad news is that if that dial cord ever broke, it was a bit of an art form to properly restring it, to figure out where the string started, stopped, how many wraps here, how many wraps there, and so on. But is that repairable? Of course. With modern day roll of sailmaker's string, sailmaker's thread, very heavy thread, the heaviest thread you can buy, maybe it's nylon loaded or whatever.
Try fishing cord too.
There you go, fishing cord would probably also do it, and I think that was, N2MB, that was, not like Barry was giving us that information. Barry, when you restrung a dial cord on a antique radio, did you use fishing cord, a nylon fishing string, would that do it? N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW in the TechNet, or wait for a couple of seconds beyond the beep?
Okay. They had nylon fishing cord, of course, and they also had a kind of a stranded wire which you could use too. It was it looked like it was thin, had very very fine wire in it that was kind of weaved, and that was pretty good too. That lasted forever. But the most popular was nylon fishing cord. Though, over.
That's another very good suggestion. Certain brands of dental floss have got a lot of very strong material as the main core of the dental floss, with all kinds of fancy flocking, so to speak. Oral-B, I think is the name of Oral-B, makes a very kind of super floss or ultra floss stuff that I like using, very strong, and I'm positive it would make an extremely good dial cord. In fact, the radio-controlled model airplane enthusiasts will sometimes use dental floss as the hinging material for the ailerons, rudder, and elevator of their radio-controlled model airplane. So dental floss is another very strong material. So the combination of the right kind of fishing string, nylon, mylar, Dacron, and so on, dental floss, and sailmakers thread. There's various materials you can use to restring the dial cord. And if you go to the right website, I guarantee somebody will show you the actual string diagram for the dial cord of classic receivers like Hallicrafters. Let me drop. I guarantee that somewhere on the planet there is a Hallicrafters Lovers Society of people who took this classic receiver, for which there was a bunch of model numbers, and that was an extremely popular device in the mid-50s and mid-60s, and as such, there's got to be antique wireless-type enthusiasts out there who will have a website that will show you the screening diagram. And even if you get it wrong, you can still make it work, if you know what I mean. Is that repairable? Extremely so. That's about as repairable as replacing the rubber feet on the bottom of the cabinet because they've decayed with age. In either case, it's about as difficult to do that repair. So that's to bring that receiver up to its original working condition on that vernier dial. The main dial tunes the frequency probably with a dial cord. In fact, if you look at the stringing of the main dial and you look at the stringing of the vernier dial, the band spread dial, the stringing probably is extremely similar, and if you copy one into the other, you'll make it work. Very, very repairable. Let me drop one other comment I want to make.
T6, does that hang up somewhere at WSUS?
Does it hang up somewhere? No. Dial cord always wears out. In other words, if you make the mistake of turning the any one of your frequency dials all the way to the right-hand side or the left-hand side, and you continue turning the knob, you're now creating mechanical wear on that spring in a very specific spot, and you'll eventually create a failure there. So bringing it all the way to one extreme end or the other end is one of the aggravating factors that can create a failure. Very rarely does a variable capacitor have a hang-up somewhere in the middle of its tuning range. Not impossible, but not likely. But to get to the very first subject that Mel talked about on his last two transmissions ago, and that is, Mel and I do get some very nice left-handed compliments from time to time. College students will send us their college homework. On a couple of occasions, we got somebody's doctoral thesis for review. It's a very nice compliment to think that we have the smarts to do that, way beyond the call of duty of what we have volunteered to do. As Mel was saying, we are not volunteering to give you a free written consulting service. The so-called mailbag, the email service of the TechNet, is intended for beginning radio amateurs. One of the very nice things that Mel and I experience is that quite a number of times per year, we'll get a letter from somebody who said, somebody told me about you, my college professor said I'm going to get acquaintance with wireless techniques by listening to the TechNet, or I went scanning around with my scanner and I found you guys. One way or another, I found you guys. You're having a lot of fun. We decided, boy, I want to join that, and they went out and got a ham license. In the process of getting that ham license, a bunch of questions have to be answered, and they don't yet have the license to get on the air. And so when we get one of those letters, and we think it's sincere, and it's not somebody just being phony about it, we answer their questions. They go to the top of our priority list because we like to do some evangelizing, Mel and I. So we get a significant number of people who said, I found you guys. I went and got a ham license. I'm now very happy. Thank you very much for doing what you do. So those are the kinds of questions we really are volunteering to answer, if you know what I mean. Not somebody's college homework or their doctoral thesis. It's a nice compliment, but it's way beyond what we volunteered to do. K2KEY, I know you can fix that dial cord rather easily. What do you think, Mel? I bet you've restrung 10 of them in your life. I bet you own a mile of dial cord. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And a quick comment, Dick, when you get a chance.
Okay, John. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yes, I just wanted to throw it out to everybody so that they can hear about old radio, basically. All right. The restringing of the dial cord, if you want to get the original dial cord, that's still available. Write this down. Tell you exactly how to get it. It's for 25 feet, will push through $3.75. Yes, $3.75 for 25 feet of the original cord. The company that has it, write this down, go to their website. You can easily order it right there and then. It's www.radio, R-A-D-I-O, D-A-Z-E, one word, radiodays.com. Radio Days, www.radiodays.com. Just type in dial cord, and you'll see. It'll come right up. I'm going to drop it, and I'll say a few more words about stringing. Okay. Now you got the dial cord. How do you string it? You go to Boat Anchors. Google Boat Anchors. Boat Anchors will take you to a site where all the old equipment is listed, and you put in Helicrafters and the number. It most likely, most of the Helicrafters receivers, you'll notice has an SX, a sugar X-ray number on it. And that SX number, with the number after it, putting that in, will bring up the boat anchor, will bring up that radio, and you just request what you're looking for, schematic, tube layout, whatever, or, in this case, dial cord. So that's just the thing. You're going to go to Radio Days, and you're going to go to boatanchors.com, and it's very straightforward. They'll tell you basically how to do it. In fact, it most likely could be a procedure in the Helicrafters manual, actually, on, you know, how to take the panel off. But you will have to remove the front panel, the knobs and the front panel. While you got it off, you can clean it all up, check the see if the dial lights are working and all, and very easy, very straightforward repair. If it's a working receiver, you're very lucky to go that far. Okay, Dave, get back in, and I have something else. Go ahead.
Yeah, interesting piece of history. I got my ham license way back in the dark ages of 1956. I'm on Morse code, 40-meter, novice band. Managed to find a guy in Brooklyn. He and I talked back and forth quite a few times, and struck up a friendship. I had to visit New York City in order to take my general class exam, and I decided to stop off in Brooklyn and visit him. He had just the previous week decided to buy what he believed was the Cadillac receiver, a Helicrafters SX-100, Sugar X-Ray 100. And he told me about the nervousness he had when he took $325 in his pocket, went down to Broadway, I guess it was Barry Electronics, in order to buy this SX-100 receiver, which was, in his day, a real Cadillac. Picture, in 1956, $325 or $320, whatever it was, by modern-day standards, that's an awful lot of money. And that was one of these receivers with two of those dial cords, one on the main frequency tuning dial and one on the so-called band spread dial, the so-called vernier dial. John wanted to make a comment. KC2, WGB, I bet you've strung a few dial cords in your time, John, because I think you almost come back as long as, been around almost as long as Mel and I, K2RIW TechNet. You got it, John.
Oh, yes, Dick, you're 100% right. My comment, well, Mel covered it pretty well, as usual. There's also another place, Antique Radio. That was the other comment that I was going to make. And don't forget the Rosin. And it's a lot of fun doing it. It really is. And you can use almost anything. Little Rosin on there, and that really makes the job a pleasure. So I wish those guys a lot of luck with that. It's great bringing things back to life. Back to you, Dick.
I think Rosin really is a kind of sap out of something like a pine tree. Where does one go to buy Rosin these days, John? Over to you, John.
They call it anti-slip for dial cords, and it's basically rosin. Any music store you can get it. Comes in 1-inch square.
Isn't that amazing? Rosin does a good job to help the soldering work well. Rosin does a good job of giving you friction on things like a dial cord. And the rosin itself comes from a music store. What a mixture of technologies. Mel, go right ahead with your next mailbag. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Let me pause first to see if anybody else wants to join us.
KC2QAQ with the pendant.
Okay, hold on everybody. Give it 10 seconds. I want to make sure because it comes in via one of the other modes. As Eric said, you've got to give it at least 10 seconds. Yeah, very good. On the, new dial cord usually. No problem. Usually doesn't slip. Usually new dial cord. Starts like you think it, you know, to stretch out, wear out, you know, that's when the problem starts. But most of it, of course, is just plain age, dries out, whatever. So, it's, I could say, fixable, and as John said, Antique Wireless is another place where you'll find information. But boat anchors has always been very good. They've, more or less covered just about everything from the 30s right up into the 80s with old radios. I've had a lot of success with boat anchors. So, okay, one more thing I'll bring out here. Let's drop. Have you been able to, well, I should say this, do you read the Sunday New York Times? There was quite an article on what the, in the series called Digital Domain. And the article is titled, Should You Be Snuggling With Your Cell Phone? And let me tell you something, this article has, boy, presented a lot of ammunition for people that are opposing cell phone powers, et cetera, Dick. I wonder if you do get the New York Times on Sunday, if you have to pick up on this article, over.
I vaguely remember that the New York Times last Sunday had an article on the subject, and maybe you're telling me there's one this Sunday. And although the New York Times normally is an extremely authoritative source of good information, because there is such a huge fervor of people who really are scared to death of the word radio frequency radiation and the RF radiation that comes from a cell phone or a cell phone base station is something that scares the living daylights out of people. They're positive that all kinds of damage to human beings are taking place, despite the fact that the subject has been investigated extremely thoroughly by your best institutions and testing laboratories worldwide, every single country, every single developed nation, for 60 solid years has been studying the subject. The chances of there for it being some kind of a sneak method by which it is doing damage to you, and it hasn't been discovered like asbestos or cigarette smoking, the fact that RF energy could fall into that category is almost out of the question. I just bought a book printed by a person. Let me drop. I've forgotten the name of the book, but I just bought the book, even though it was for a short period of time on the New York Times bestseller list, which basically is telling you that cell phones are extremely dangerous, doing all kinds of damage to people, and this is part of the reason why places like Bayville, Long Island, that village, and Hempstead Township are doing some terrible things to try to stop the installation of cell phone base stations. Cell phones, in my opinion, are the best safety tool that mankind has ever invented, and for all of these fears, which I'm 99% convinced are irrational fears, but very respected places, very respected people, places like the New York Times can easily have an article telling you that all kinds of danger is taking place. That doesn't mean that the data itself is traceable to the Bureau. You take a very sincere person like Paul Brodeur, one of the very respected writers from the New Yorker magazine, has published a couple of books on the subject of radio frequency biohazard. One of them is called The Zapping of America, and the other one is talking about 60 cycle power called Current of Death. These are fairly popular books written by a sincere man, gathering what he thought was the available information, putting it all in one spot. As nice a guy as he is, I think he's awfully wrong, and the better places like Science Magazine and Scientific American have discredited these books and what they seem to be implying. So give me a couple of words on what the New York Times seems to be saying, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the deck net.
If this is the article from last Sunday, Dick. Did you happen to get to have a chance to look at it? Over.
I do remember seeing it at the time, but I've seen quite a few of these, what I'm going to call terrible articles. I'm having trouble remembering this one. It's not in my pile of things that go into a file folder of subjects on that, I mean, articles on that particular subject. And tell me what you, you've now seen it a lot more recently than I have. What does it seem to be saying, Mel? And I guarantee you, if they're saying cell sites are dangerous, I know they're wrong. If they're saying the cell phone itself is dangerous, if you stretch it a little bit and you say that a five-year-old child should not be on the cell phone 1 hour per day, I'm going to sort of agree with that. But beyond that, I think we're being way too alarmist on this one and misunderstanding the physics. Over to you, Mel.
W2SCT Mobile.
Peter recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is KQKEY. Well, basically, the article was written by Randall Strauss. He says he's an author based in Silicon Valley, and he's also a professor of business at San Jose State University. And he goes on to say that in the article, he mentions that there were 400 papers, that scientific papers, on possible biological effects of radiation from wireless communication that have been filed. And found, he says they found that 28% of the studies, which concerned the cell phone industry, funding showed some sort of effect. So that's basically one part of it. There's another piece of it that says that the Federal Communications Commission mandates that the SAR produced by phones be no more than 1.6 watts per kilogram. Let me let it drop. 1.6 watts per kilogram. One study by a scientist by the name of Mr. Lai, L-A-I, found effects like the loss of memory in rats when they were exposed to a SAR value in the value, a range of 0.0006 to approximately 0.06 watts per kilogram. He says, I originally did not expect this effect even at these low levels, but it was a definite, repeatable experiment. And it goes on and on and on, and about the cell phone industry trying to add disclaimers on ways you should handle cell phones, Dick, over.
Isn't a rat 1/20th the size of a human being?
Absolutely, Peter. And Peter, I'm going to go over to you in a second. The United States current standard, specific absorption rate, SAR, 1.6 watts per kilogram, that's the unit, watts per kilogram, but you assess it for the nearest gram of material, the nearest cubic centimeter of material, and you adjust it per by 1.6 milliwatts per milligram, per gram instead of a kilogram. All American manufactured and sold telephones in the United States don't exceed 1.6. And you can go to a particular website that will list the SAR of all of those cell phones. And as I told you guys before, they go all the way down to about 0.5 and all the way up to 1.55, even though the spec is 1.6. And the most conservative people in the world seem to be the Brits, who tell you that a child under 9 years of age shouldn't use a cell phone. And you think that the Brits are really more conservative. However, we allow 1.6 watts per kilogram. They allow 2.0. So are they really conservative? It's an interesting question. This Professor Lai, he is that famous guy. I think he's a guy from France who has been selling. He's been saying these alarming things now for many years. He has been discredited by a number of the better scientific journals as a man who is sincere and trying to indicate what he thinks is a danger. But his methodology has not necessarily been accepted. And yes, a mouse, let me drop, A mouse is a much smaller animal. A mouse doesn't have the intelligence to say, gee, my eye feels uncomfortable. I'm going to move away from that if you're giving the mouse an overexposure and you clamp him down on some particular kind of test fixture. Would a human being do that, so to speak? I mean, when you do an experiment on a mouse, even if you did it with proper quantification, the next big question is, does it really relate to a human being under normal working conditions of a human being? So there's a whole lot of steps in between what he did, how well he did it, and is it relative to human beings. I do not work for any cell phone company, so to speak. I have never, one of the companies I do quoting, I do consulting for, has sold cell phone hardware. Does that mean that I now have a biased opinion about cell phones? You'll have to be the judge of that yourself. But I can tell you that there's an awful lot of evidence that cell phones are very safe. However, there are a significant number of people who are really convinced they are not. And one of the biggest concentrations of those people seem to be in the village of Bayville. And I know that Pete, W2SET, has friends who live in the village of Bayville. There are three simultaneous lawsuits attempting to remove every single radio antenna from that village. That includes cell phone, fire, police, and ambulance services. They want all of those antennas removed from their town, regardless of the consequences. As I said, there were three simultaneous lawsuits, which in my opinion don't stand a chance of being successful, but the majority, a significant percentage of the 7,000 residents of that village are behind these lawsuits. And I wonder if you got some opinions on how that's going among the people that you know who live there, Pete.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So I wonder if you know how those three simultaneous lawsuits are proceeding, Pete. W2SET, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, W2SET, Smallville. I'll just be in here for the one transmission. Very slowly, actually, going through a little bit of a riptide because Dick Siegel got, she didn't run again. So we have a new mayor and we have two or three new trustees on board now. So we're going through a transition, so that's slowing up the process here. I'm going to keep you updated. I did inquire about things and they kept saying it's being held at bay, so to speak. They really are going through a transition process, so they said to me. And I'll keep you updated on that, but basically the transitional process is holding up everything, the lawsuits, the town's handling of it, and everybody seems to be on board about giving it a little more time, like another 3, 4, 5 months until they can clear the corner on where we're going to go with it. But everything you said, I think, is very accurate, and it's very silly. And to the other station, it's just overreaction, because when you can compare a rat to a human being, you're talking about a rat is probably not even a 30th of the size of a human being, maybe 1/25. And so that 0.0006 can be 0.30 zeros before the 6. I've been operating with a cell phone for a while, and I just don't see this hysteria. It's just hysteria. Complete hysteria. We drop it. And I think it's overreaction on the part of many people, which has caused problems with getting cell phone coverage into our area here, where we have terrible phone coverage, Old Brookville, and again, that's wealth, now pure wealth, pushing out people, Old Brookville, Upper Brookville, this area I live in is surrounded by very wealthy estates, that, and the people in those villages push it out. They really don't understand what's going on. had on it, and I've lived in the Bayville Village for 20 years since 1990, and a lot of people feel the same way. There's a certain group here that's doing this, as Dick said, so let me turn it back to Dick for net control, and 72 to everybody. Have a good evening and a good week ahead. Happy Thanksgiving. Dick, back to you, and we'll catch up with you later in the week. W2SCT Waldorf.
As I said earlier, Pete has a number of friends who live in the village of Bayville. The former mayor of the village of Bayville is a lady named Victoria Siegel. Very nice lady. I gave testimony before that town board about a year and a half or so ago, describing what I think is the safety of cell phone base stations. Victoria Siegel, as mayor, with her cabinet of trustees, were strongly in favor of all of the antennas in that town remaining. They know the safety to human life that those antennas are providing for law enforcement, fire, cell phones, and whatever. However, there appears to be at least one or two very charismatic people in that village who have convinced a high percentage of the 7,000 residents that these things are a danger to their health, to their children, and they must be eliminated. And so there's been this battle going on for a significant number of years. It's going to go on for more years because it doesn't stand a chance. It's my belief that it doesn't stand a chance for two reasons. One, the perceived danger, I am strongly of the belief, does not really exist. Second of all, there are major organizations that will not allow you to eliminate these safety devices from a community. Let me drop. The county won't let you do it. The state won't let you do it. The Department of Homeland Security won't let you do it. And the federal government won't let you do it. The Communication Act of 1996 makes it very clear. You cannot deny the sighting of a cell phone base station based on a perceived risk of radio frequency biohazard. You can say, yes, I don't want it in my community because it's unsightly, and you got to make it look like a tree. Now, those are rational decisions. But to think that you're going to eliminate cell phones in the 21st century is about as likely as you're going to eliminate a water supply, you're going to eliminate the police department or whatever. You just can't do that. You can try very hard. You can spend a lot of money. There are attorneys who will take your money, and they will take that case because you need defense. But you don't have a rational thing that you're trying to defend. You can't really give strong evidence of the perceived risk. There isn't any after 60 years of study. So where Hempstead Town and where Bayville Village are trying to eliminate cell sites, they don't stand a chance. It's going to eventually go to a federal court which strikes down that ruling. Just to give you another example, in the township, in the town of Oyster Bay Cove, when that Columbia airliner crashed about 10 or 15 years ago, a significant number of people passed away because emergency services could not be brought to bear because there is no cell phone coverage in that particular community. Oyster Bay Township and Oyster Bay Town, and particularly Oyster Bay Cove, have not allowed any cell phone base stations in that community. Therefore, you go there and you need emergency communication. You do not have it. What little communication existed because the law enforcement agencies were talking from the ground up to a helicopter that was talking out of the community, or ham radio operators were providing a small amount of communication during that event. So as I said,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's a significant amount of evidence that a number of people perished because of a lack of communication during that event. And now for any community in the United States to say, I'm going to get rid of all the cell phones, the agencies won't let you do it, and if you succeeded, you're going to create increased number of people of perishing. That's a very poor decision to make. I used to say that if you really want to live without all of these modern conveniences, you have to live with the Amish and the Mennonites in places like Pennsylvania. Well, you can't even do that, because the Mennonites and the Amish people have gotten smart enough to loan out a few square feet of their land to various agencies that have established cell phone base stations on their farm land. You can't even do that. If you're going to live in the modern world, if you really want to live without these particular modern conveniences, I don't know where you're going to have to go, but I guarantee you're going to live a very primitive life when you go there. The genie is out of the bottle. We just love, as a community, wireless products. We just can't get enough of them. Bunch of opinions, as you can tell.